Welcome to Poker Fraud Alert Radio. I'm your host, Todd Dandruff Witelis. This is being brought to you live and recorded live on September 1st, 2024. The time right now, 3:44 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is going to be another kind of mini episode. I don't quite have the ability to do the long episodes with the vocal issues I have right now, given my cough that keeps coming up whenever I talk. So basically, I have to mute it when I'm going to cough, and then in editing, I can take it out. But I can't do a long show that way, and this is still an after effect of COVID, which I caught nearly 2 months ago. So kind of sucks, but hopefully one day this will get better. Unfortunately, there's just nothing I can do about it. But I don't want to make this stop me from being able to do this show. So I'm going to do the show, and if I have to do shorter episodes, I will. Anyway, obviously there's a lot of things I missed over the time I wasn't doing the show. We did cover Phantom Poker on the little mini episode we did last week, but that was our only topic. I'll try to get to a few topics this week before I shut it down. I do like to stick to some more current topics rather than talk about things that happened 2 months ago that I just didn't get to report on because this show, as you can hear, my voice is not completely back yet. Anyway, I want to jump first into the topic of Scott Ball. I'm not sure if you heard about this story. It's pretty big on Twitter like about 4 or 5 days ago, but it's kind of died. So you may have missed it, but I want to talk about Scott Ball. So Scott Ball is a high-stakes cash player, and he has been in some controversy over the years. He's not someone with the best reputation, but I will admit that whenever I saw him called out in the past, while there were some allegations against him, I never really saw any proof. So this is the type of thing where I read things on Twitter where people were saying things about him that were not very flattering, to say the least, and this is someone I wouldn't have trusted just based upon that. But at the same time, who knows? You know, these stories could have been false. They could have been exaggerated. There could have been another side to the story. And the allegations were never accompanied with any kind of real proof. So I kind of just dismissed them at the time. I didn't even discuss them on this show because the whole thing was just too confusing and there just was not enough proof about what was being alleged. So I just kind of looked past that and just kept in the back of my mind that these allegations had been made against him at various times over the years. The last round of allegations came in 2021, and he escaped those mostly unscathed, and there hasn't been much said about him since. But that all changed on August 23rd, 2024, and this was brought to the public's attention by Seriously Serious Thomas Keeling, who works for Doug Polk, doing video work for him. And I guess Thomas is a fan of the YouTuber named Ludwig, whose real name is Ludwig Ahgren, A-H-G-R-E-N. And he was watching Ludwig discussing during some kind of chat about ACR and how he felt ripped off by them back in 2022. So this is what Seriously Serious tweeted on August 23rd. He wrote, "Big streamer Ludwig says that America's Card Room refused to pay him out. He says it's his biggest regret in working with a sponsor and that they're a, quote, dog shit site." So I'm going to play you what Ludwig said, because this was attached by Seriously Serious to his post on August 23rd. And then we will discuss it.
"Of all the sponsors you've done, which one do you regret the most? The sponsor that I regret the most is a poker company I used to work with called American Card Room. I was only sponsored to play poker. They did have a casino, but I never got sponsored to play the casino, only the poker. Now, you might think I regret it because I was promoting gambling or something. I didn't give a fuck about that. I think poker is a dope game. I think anyone should be allowed to play poker if they're of age and have enough funds and money and understand the game, of course. So I actually don't have a problem with that at all. The reason I regret it is because that company refused to pay me out. And the money that I earned playing poker, because I won a bunch of tournaments, I would then gamble on their site. And it was so fucking hard to pull the money out. And so if it's hard for me, it means it's hard for the other people who I was promoting it to play poker. And so I stopped working with them because I think they're kind of a dog shit site. That's my one probably regret for companies.
So that was Ludwig. And I'm sure Seriously Serious was surprised to hear that, because Ludwig is a recreational poker player. In fact, he appeared on Hustler Casino Live at least once. But he's really just a streamer. He's really just someone who does YouTube videos and stuff like that. He's not somebody who is really poker associate. He's just a guy who's famous for other reasons that also plays poker. So I'm sure Seriously Serious was surprised to see that and shared it. Then he also wrote, Seriously Serious, last month, another big streamer named Wubby, who worked with ACR in 2022, said that he hasn't been paid for a poker sponsorship deal and that this is, quote, being litigated currently. And he attached the statement from Wubby that said, we have done multiple Gamba, G-A-M-B-A, I'm not sure what that is, streams, and I'm not sure what this is referencing beyond that. If this is referencing the money I was receiving from my poker sponsorship, I've yet to receive any money, and this is something being litigated currently. So what does this have to do with Scott Ball? Well, we'll get to that. Alexandra Botez, who is a chess player and another social media influencer, she's better known in poker than Ludwig. Now, Ludwig is more famous than Alexandra Botez, but as far as in poker, she plays more poker than Ludwig does. Ludwig just plays occasionally and kind of likes the game. Alexandra is trying to play a good deal of poker, and she really seems to enjoy poker. So anyway, she tweeted, ACR hasn't paid out dozens of creators for sponsored streams from well over a year ago, myself included. ACR contracted Endgame Talent, which is Scott Ball's company, I'll discuss them shortly, and blames them for ripping them off. While that complicates things, I spoke with the ACR CEO, whose name is Phil Nagy, who promised to make things right, but instead ghosted. They are not trustworthy. So that was pretty shocking to read. Jamie Staples wrote back a few things. I don't have a dog in this fight, but I bet heavily on Endgame wrongdoing over ACR here. So basically, Jamie is saying, I think the one who screwed you here was Scott Ball, not ACR. So Alexandra Botez responded, I'm starting to think that also. But it also feels bad when ACR says they'll help and then crickets. Endgame also said that if anyone sues, they will liquidate their assets and declare bankruptcy. So can't even take legal action, LOL. Well, when Ludwig saw that this was being discussed, he responded to Seriously Serious and wrote this. Clarifying some points here. One, the payments were handled through the sole agency ACR contracted at the time, Endgame. Two, the payment, if I remember correctly, was over a year late. Three, when I tried going through ACR directly, the head of Endgame found out and called me and told me that the CEO of ACR was very good friends with him and that it was foolish of me. Four, I was paid out shortly after and never did another deal with either group. Five, the payouts were more difficult from ACR back when I was playing in 2020, and many people say good things about the speed of payouts now. Six, this is my experience from years ago, unsure how either entity operates now. So basically, Ludwig was saying that when he did the promotion of ACR, that Endgame was the company that was supposed to be paying him. So ACR was not supposed to be paying him directly. Then a year passed and he was not paid. So he went to ACR and said, what the hell? Why haven't I gotten paid? And then Endgame, aka Scott Ball, called him very quickly and said, what are you doing? Why are you calling ACR? Why are you bothering the CEO about this? You know, he and I are very good friends. That was a big mistake. You shouldn't have made me look bad like that. So basically, he's claiming Scott Ball went off on him for going to the ACR CEO about not being paid instead of to him directly, as if Ludwig is the one who's at fault for not being paid for over a year. And then shortly after that, despite Scott Ball giving him a hard time, he got paid after that very quickly. And then he said, well, screw that. I'm not working with either of them anymore. He also complained that just from winning some tournaments on ACR separately, that the cash outs were very slow. And he's saying that he's heard that since then they've spit out their payouts and that's not a problem anymore. But he's saying basically that was his experience. A person named Sly responded to Ludwig saying Wubby had the same issue as you with not being paid out, and he worked with them 1 to 2 years ago. ACR then put out a statement knowing that this was making them look bad. ACR put, ACR Poker engaged a third-party agency, of course that being Endgame Talent, to arrange brand marketing by streamers they purported to represent. Every streamer worked under their own talent agency. ACR paid the central agency, which was to pay the streamers through their respective talent agents. That arrangement unfortunately ended with serious disputes about whether the central agency stiffed or underpaid the various talent agencies or their individual streamer clients. ACR stands by our positive track record with sponsored players, marketing campaigns, and streamers' talent agencies. The company that reportedly failed to pay talent agencies is believed to have been sued by the streamers' talent agencies. Okay, let me stop right there and discuss that. So, ACR is basically saying, yes, this happened, but it's not our fault. We paid what we were supposed to pay to Endgame, and then Endgame stiffed the talent agencies who were then supposed to pay the streamers. Which sounds like a lot of unnecessary layers here. So ACR, while I do think they're telling the truth, I don't know for sure, but my gut feeling is they are telling the truth. They're not blameless in this, as I will get to shortly. Before we get to that, let me read the strange response that Scott Ball gave. Scott Ball wrote on his Twitter, at ACR Poker, at Poker.org, I guess he wants them to report on this. This response, referring to what ACR responded about this, the thing I just read to you, appears to be a creative and transparent attempt at obfuscation and deflection, drafted by someone who seems to be unfamiliar with the facts of the matter. A complete and correct accounting of the ACR third-party and influencer dealings would provide a more interesting and relevant read. I would be happy to send materials in my possession, including contracts and communications, to a neutral third party to assess if ACR approves of that action and agrees to do the same. A caveat of this offer would be that all the materials we submit would be available to the public. Interested parties may DM me. And then about a day after that, he also wrote to Phil Nagy publicly, Phil, you haven't been sued because you're in Costa Rica. Stop playing stupid. You know the U.S. can't collect a judgment from you even when obtained. Why say no to my offer here? If you're in the right as you claim, it's a free roll. So basically what Scott Ball is offering is, let's just put all the documents out on the table. So we'll both send the documents to a third party, a neutral third party, and then the third party will present the documents to the public. He said, that's going to be part of the agreement. I'm not doing this unless we make everything public. Now, that would sound like he's being transparent, but there's a few problems with his statement here. First of all, he's not denying it. Notice he's not saying, yes, I paid out all influencers or their talent agencies as agreed. He never said that. In that statement he made there, he never denied the allegations. He just said, it would provide a interesting and relevant read to see these documents. Well, what does that mean, interesting and relevant? Did you or did you not do it, is the question. Start with that. Did you underpay or completely stiff these influencers? Or did you not underpay or stiff these influencers? It has to be one of the two. You either did what was promised, or you did not do what was promised and you owe money. So what he's basically saying is, it'll be very interesting and relevant for everyone to see all the documents involved in this streamer promoting ACR effort. Now, you may say, well, what's wrong with that? If we see the documents, we will see what happened. Well, he could be offering this because there could be things that the streamers wouldn't want being seen, such as what they're being paid for this. So maybe he's thinking that ACR and the streamers will be embarrassed when it comes out how much was being paid total to have these streamers promote ACR, and that the poker community will think ACR was wasting its money. I mean, that's their business if they want to spend that way, but maybe he's thinking that they don't want to make this public. The streamers don't want to make this public. ACR don't want to make it public. So he's offering for this whole transparent document dump for the entire public to see, and then say, hey, Phil Nagy, why aren't you agreeing to this? Well, because there's no need for a public document dump unless you're disputing something. So start off answering yes or no, what is being alleged is correct or it's incorrect. That's what you got to start off with. And if it's incorrect, then just say, okay, it's incorrect. Here's what's incorrect. But just telling ACR to dump their documents and you'll do it too, and if they refuse, that means that you're in the right. That doesn't necessarily mean that. I responded to Scott Ball. I said, I'll do it. Meaning I'll be the third party guy handling this if you want. Just to be clear, are you denying that you or your company owe influencers money for promoting ACR? And of course, he did not answer. Not a surprise at all. So my gut feeling is that he did stiff these influencers. However, ACR does not get a free pass here. Why was ACR paying the influencers through Endgame Talent, aka Scott Ball? Why? I guess it's easier to just send a lump payment to Endgame Talent and let them handle it. But Endgame Talent is not a major talent agency. I'm sure you haven't heard of it before. So why is ACR trusting them with what's probably pretty large money? Probably was like eight figures is my guess. Why was ACR trusting Endgame to handle all that money and to pay the influencers properly? It's not like it was very small money and they figured that it's easier to just send it to Endgame, who will then forward it on. This is probably big money. It's got to be seven or eight figures. I don't know what it is total, how many influencers they hired, but it's got to be a lot of money because these influencers don't work cheap. So why would you send it to a small so-called talent agency and just hope the money ends up in the right place? That's a mistake. I don't know how this deal got done. I have to imagine that Ball probably contacted these influencers and brought them to ACR, and ACR agreed. But that doesn't matter. What should have happened is they should have paid Ball whatever his part was going to be in this whole thing, whatever his commission was going to be, and then sent the money directly either to these influencers or their talent agencies. But whoever they sent the money to, if it wasn't going to be the influencers themselves, it would have to be a very reputable and large operation that you know is not going to stiff them. And Scott Ball does not qualify as that. So the fact that they kicked it all to Scott Ball and said, okay, we've paid you, now pay them. Okay, we're washing our hands of it. I don't think they were intending to do anything wrong. I don't think ACR was intending to have these influencers get screwed. And I think they probably paid what they agreed to pay. So in that manner, they're fine. But it was stupid. It was stupid to trust Scott Ball with all that money. And indeed, it looks like he probably did not pay out what he was supposed to, because he's not even denying it on his Twitter. Now, why should ACR care about this? Well, you're seeing why they should care, because the optics are bad. The last thing they should want would be big names like Ludwig getting on YouTube and bashing them as dishonest and shady. So ACR really should bear, at the very minimum, some moral responsibility regarding not verifying Endgame stability, legitimacy, and likelihood of actually paying the influencers. Because if they had, they would not have sent Scott Ball the money. Just the rumors about him doing shady shit in previous years should have been enough not to have him hold anyone's money. So there's no reason he should have been handling the money. Now, I'm not talking about legally, by the way. I'm just talking about morally. They should not have sent Scott Ball that money. So once this has happened, what is ACR's responsibility now? Notice that Alexandra Botez claimed that Phil Nagy told her that he would take care of it and then just ghosted. And I think I believe that, too. I can't see why she'd lie about that. But should ACR have to basically double pay for this, given that they agreed to pay Endgame talent? They apparently did pay Endgame talent. So isn't this Scott Ball's responsibility, since he was said to have stolen the money? Well, yes, but because ACR made this mistake by trusting Scott Ball too much, they do bear some moral responsibility here to make it right. And also from a business standpoint, it's just good to not have these influencers bash you. Because not only does that undo any kind of goodwill that ACR got from being promoted by these influencers, now it's bad will. Now it's basically people are going to stay away that are fans of Ludwig or Wubby or Alexandra Botez. So that now they're getting harmed by these influencers because they're not making this right. Whereas if they made it right, I think these influencers would come out and speak in their favor. I think they'd say, hey, look, the talent agency that was the go-between screwed us, but ACR paid us anyway. They paid double, basically, because initially the money got stolen, and instead of just leaving us high and dry, they paid us. That would have looked great for them. So telling the influencers that they're going to pay and then ghosting is pretty bad. To me, it looks like the only one who got paid was Ludwig. And this was after Ludwig went directly to Phil Nagy, and then Scott Ball all of a sudden went to him. So, whoa, hold on, you know, we'll pay you. You shouldn't have gone to him, man. We're good friends. You're making me look bad. But okay, look, here's the money. I don't know what the problem is. That looks like what Ludwig is claiming happened when he went to Phil Nagy about not getting paid by Scott Ball. I'm not sure why it was important at the time for Scott Ball to pay him. Maybe because he had the biggest voice, because he has a pretty big following, Ludwig. But whatever it was, he got paid, albeit over a year late. Ludwig, by the way, has almost 2 million followers. So he is pretty well known. I asked my son about Ludwig. He had heard of him. So if you're trying to reach young people and get them to sign up and play poker on your site, Ludwig is a good one to promote it. And Ludwig really does enjoy playing poker, so it's not like just getting some random YouTuber to talk about, I like playing on America's Card Room, the games are very good. Like, Ludwig actually plays, and he sounds like he knows what he's talking about. So, he was actually a good one to get, but to not pay him for over a year is crazy. A person named Flow Junkie wrote in response to Scott Ball, I'm guessing you're betting ACR won't want to agree to this, and if they do, you'll just say your lawyers told you not to. Really no comment on why, quote, good people said you owe them money? Were they mistaken? He's basically asking what I did. Why aren't you denying it, and why would these people be lying? Scott Ball said back, the opposite, our counsel, he spelled counsel, C-O-U-N-C-I-L, like a city council, not a council like legal counsel, C-O-U-N-S-E-L. So he wrote, the opposite, our council would love to handle things this way. I guess it's city council? No, his lawyer, he's trying to say. It's impossible to collect a judgment from a company in Costa Rica in the States. If Phil wants to do things the poker way with neutral arbitration, it gives us a chance to collect. That's kind of weird. He's acting like he's owed money by ACR, but why not just show it? So then he also responded to somebody who was mocking him about the council. Show the Jedi Council from one of the Star Wars films. Said, oh yeah, your council. And then Scott Ball said back, must not have read the original tweet mentioning neutral arbitration. And the guy whose name is Brian Eslinger wrote back, you're right, I didn't. I'm just impressed you can claim to be such a successful businessman and don't know the difference between the two councils. I'm just a nobody looking in from the outside, but you seem scummy and your word vomit doesn't really help. Scott Ball says back, oh man, my grammar and English straight up sucks. Was never a strong suit, nor do I think I claim anywhere I'm such a successful businessman. But if you can point that out, let me know. Brian Eslinger said back, nothing in print to point to, all anecdotal, some stories from personal friends and some stories from public figures in the poker world. He's basically heard the types of stuff I have, this Brian guy, about Scott Ball. Scott Ball also denied that he told Alexander Botez that he will liquidate and declare bankruptcy if sued. He said, nope, we spoke for the first time in the last 48 hours versus via DM. She can show that if she'd like. A lot of people asking just straight up, did you pay the influencers? And he's not answering. So I think we have our answer. If he paid them, he'd just say it. In these types of situations, it's real simple. If someone says, I never got paid by such and such person owes me money, such and such person scammed me, and then the person responds back with a big word salad and doesn't just say yes or no, this is true, well, then it's almost always true. Because if you're accused of something you didn't do, the first thing you're going to say is, I did not do it. You say, I did not do it. I can prove I didn't do it. All the documents will show I didn't do it. What do you want me to do to show I didn't do it? Here, let me show everybody why I didn't do it. That's what someone innocent will say. Someone who's guilty will try to confuse you and throw out a lot of nonsense to try to complicate the situation, but will not directly confirm or deny the allegations. So that's very, very suspicious, to say the least. Endgame Talent has shut down, apparently. Their website seems to be gone. There's also a court judgment against Endgame Talent in June of 2024 for $718,000. So I have to imagine that there's a lot more going on with Scott Ball than just this situation. This lawsuit was filed in LA County Court. Poker.org found it. And it was a default judgment against Endgame for $718,331. It was for breach of contract and was filed by Loaded LLC. And Loaded LLC is a talent agency for streamers. So this may be related, it may be not, but whatever's going on here, it's pretty clear Endgame Talent seems to be over with, and Scott Ball doesn't want to answer any direct questions. So that is pretty bad. ACR is not looking great here either, though. They should not have promised something to people like Alexander Botez that they will handle it and then decide not to and run off. They also shouldn't just wash their hands of it. Again, they made a giant mistake paying Endgame Talent instead of paying the influencers or their talent agencies directly. Whenever you pay a third-party agency to distribute most of the money to the person who is being represented, whenever you do that, you got to make sure that the agency you're paying is reputable. You can't just kick the whole thing out to the agency and say, okay, our work is done, you handle it now. Because if you're dealing with a scammer, then the influencers will never get paid. So a lot of times in poker, the so-called talent agents are pretty small time, and they're not always the best people. Some of them are good people, but some of them are not. So you have to be careful who you deal with, and I would think ACR would know this by now, since they have done a lot of promotion over time. So this is a pretty big blunder on their part. Not intentional, so I know there's people who are going off on them, oh, they're so shady, oh, they're so terrible. This wasn't an intentional blunder on their part. They weren't trying to scam anyone. But I think initially they were thinking they're going to make it right and then realize it's probably too much money, it's not worth it, so they just decided they're not going to do it and ghosted whoever they promised. So that's pretty bad. They need to just make this right and learn a lesson from this and go on, go forward. They make a lot of money on there every single day, so there's no reason to just try to wash their hands of this. So I hope the influencers hold ACR's feet to the fire and pressure them to handle this, because I have a feeling Scott Ball is broke. He's probably going to be squeezing blood from a stone to get anything out of him at this point. I think if Scott Ball was doing great, then he would have paid these influencers as promised. I don't think this was necessarily stolen just for the sake of stealing. I think this was stolen probably because he needed the money. That would be my guess. Moving on, I want to talk about a change at the World Series of Poker that's a pretty big story, but it didn't get very much discussion beyond the first maybe 2 days after it happened. But this is going to make a difference starting in 2025. So the World Series of Poker has been owned by Harrah's / Caesars ever since 2004. So that's why Caesars has been in charge of the World Series for the entire time that we've had this show. And I didn't think that was going to change. In fact, I assumed that the World Series of Poker was going to be a Caesars product until the day I die. But that is not true, because I am not dead, and the World Series of Poker is no longer owned by Caesars. Yeah, the World Series of Poker has been sold. Who bought the World Series of Poker? And why may you not have heard about this? Well, the World Series of Poker has been sold to NSUS, NSUS Group, Inc. Have you heard of NSUS Group, Inc.? Probably not. So who are they? Well, NSUS Group, Inc. is actually GG Poker. So the World Series of Poker has sold to GG Poker. This was announced on August 1st. Caesars Entertainment's Twitter, which is Caesars ENT, wrote the following. We announced the signing of a definitive agreement to sell our intellectual property rights for the WSOP brand to NSUS Group, Inc. The transaction, valued at $500 million, including $250 million in cash and $250 million promissory note due 5 years after the transaction closing date. Here's the press release. Caesars Entertainment today announced the signing of a definitive agreement to sell its intellectual property rights for the World Series of Poker brand to NSUS Group, a leading investment group in the iGaming space known for successfully launching several groundbreaking ventures, including the innovative online poker room GG Poker. The transaction, valued at a total of $500 million, includes $250 million in cash, $250 million in promissory notes due 5 years after the transaction's closing date, secured by the WSOP, intellectual property assets being sold. As part of this transaction, Caesars has secured the right from NSUS to continue hosting the WSOP's flagship live tournament series at its Las Vegas casinos for the next 20 years, which of course is pretty important. We'll get to that in a second. In addition, brick-and-mortar poker rooms currently operated by Caesars will continue to feature WSOP branding, and Caesars destinations will continue to enjoy preferential rights to host live WSOP circuit events going forward. Caesars Digital will receive a license from NSUS to continue operating its recently upgraded WSOP online real money poker business in Nevada, New Jersey, Michigan, and Pennsylvania for the foreseeable future, but will otherwise be restricted from operating online peer-to-peer real money poker operations for a specified period of time and subject to certain exceptions. We will, of course, discuss that as well. A quote from Eric Hessian, who is the president of Caesars Digital: we've enjoyed a long-standing and successful poker partnership with GG Poker that has helped spur the growth of the WSOP brand. The transaction is an exciting step for Caesars as a company and the WSOP brand as it continues to evolve. We can't wait to see what NSUS has in store for growing the WSOP's legacy in poker, and we look forward to continuing this to deliver an unmatched and familiar experience to poker players going forward. Then Michael Kim, who's the CEO of NSUS Group, said, after collaborating with Caesars Entertainment for years, NSUS Group, the operators of GG Poker, is thrilled to announce their new role in leading the World Series of Poker, the world's most renowned poker brand. We will leverage GG Poker's cutting-edge technology and industry experience to create an exciting future for WSOP, ensuring that players have an increasingly improved, safe, and seamless poker experience. Under the new leadership, NSUS intends to expand WSOP worldwide, positioning it at the forefront of poker's growth. Then it says, the sale is subject to customary regulatory approvals and other closing conditions. It's expected to close near the end of 2024. Kirkland & Ellis LLP provided transactional counsel, and Latham & Watkins LLP acted as finance counsel to Caesars, while NSUS was represented by Greenberg Traurig LLP, which is interesting because Greenberg Traurig has a pretty big presence in Las Vegas. They were representing GG Poker. I actually dealt with Greenberg Traurig a bit when I had a bit of a dispute with Mason Malmuth, the former owner of the 2+2 forums. I was in the right, by the way, and they backed down. But anyway, one of Mason's lawyers at Greenberg Traurig called me and tried to intimidate me into backing down on the whole thing, and I said no. So it was a friendly conversation. In fact, I stayed on the phone for 90 minutes just to run up Mason's bill. But by the end, we did come to an agreement. I conceded a little bit, and they actually conceded a lot on their side, and we resolved it semi-amicably. But yeah, that was someone at Greenberg Traurig, which Mason liked to use. Pretty expensive firm, too. Anyway, what does all this mean? Well, before I get into the WSOP stuff, I want to tell you a bit about Michael Kim, the CEO and I believe owner, or at least the partial owner of GG Poker and Ensus. I met Michael Kim in 2022. I think I've told you guys about this before. I'm pretty sure I have. I was unexpectedly invited pretty much at the last minute, like a day before, to a private GG Poker party at a large Nobu Hotel suite. The Nobu Hotel is located within Caesar's Palace. It's unclear why GG Poker invited me. They had not invited me the previous year. They also did not invite me the following year. They invited me in 2022 and only in 2022 for unknown reasons. It almost looked like somebody advised them to invite me. I didn't meet Michael until the very end when I was going to the elevators to go down and leave. And Haley Hintz, who was walking with me, she introduced me to Michael. He happened to be there in front of the elevators as well. And at first we just were exchanging pleasantries, and I think he just saw me as just another poker pro who plays poker and doesn't know much else. But I started talking with him about GG Poker's place in the industry, how I was impressed at how it went from the ground up, basically nothing, to become the biggest poker site in the world, which it was at the time, it still is. And I even compared it to Run It Once Poker, Phil Galfond's site, which launched around the same time and completely failed. So I said, you know, one of them did all the right things, one of them did all the wrong things. And yeah, I had some criticisms for GG that I've put on the show before, but you know, there's no point to bring that up to him at the time there. I wasn't going to be adversarial with a guy who was invited to their party. I was meeting him. I wasn't going to kiss his ass, but you know, I was just, I figured I'd keep it more positive, not, hey, you know, here's what I have issues with on your site. So what I told him, I really thought, like, I didn't say anything that I didn't personally believe. I was impressed with how they grew, with how they went from a non-existent site to be the biggest in the world in a very short time. They obviously did a lot right to make that happen. There's no question about that. And he said, yeah, well, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. There's a lot of things we have to do. There's a lot of things the players don't even consider. So I started telling him, yeah, I know. And I started telling him what those things were. And he was very impressed because I was one of the few poker players who could talk to him about this type of stuff and who really, really knew the industry well from both the player standpoint and the standpoint of the sites. We had a pretty interesting discussion there for maybe 15 minutes. And yeah, I mean, he really perked up once I was talking about that sort of thing. At first, he was just being friendly. And then he suddenly broke into like a real conversation with me. Anyway, by the end, he gave me his business card and told me to contact him. He didn't say this directly, but he was implying that he wanted to possibly hire me for something within the company, that he was impressed with the conversation we had. So I thought about this. I said, well, you know, in a way, I've kind of always wanted this. In a way, I've always kind of wanted to have a meaningful position at a major online poker site. I wasn't going to be a sponsored player there like Negreanu. Like, I'm not a big name like that. But I thought maybe that he wanted to hire me for something within the company there, and not just, I guess, some low-level programmer or something, but someone who would have some kind of say and power in things. He didn't say this, but I thought that this was very possible with how he gave me his card and actually told me to contact him. He didn't just say, well, if there's anything comes up, let me know. Like, he actually gave me the card and said, contact me. But I never did. I still have the business card. I never did, though. Furthermore, right after meeting Michael Kim, I also recognized another familiar face, and that was Steve Preiss, P-R-E-I-S-S, who was known in the 2000s as Wicked Chops. You may remember him from Wicked Chops Poker, which was kind of like a gossipy blog-like site that kind of had the same tone as Never Win Poker, which I was associated with at the time. Two very different sites, because one was a blog and one was a forum. But we kind of were cooperative. We got along with Wicked Chops very well. And he knew me. I knew him. We weren't friends at any point, but we got along. We were friendly acquaintances. And I hadn't thought about or seen him in many years. But he recognized me. I recognized him. And apparently, he was a high-level executive at GG at the time. I think the number two or number three guy there. And we talked for like 15, 20 minutes about the old days and just what he's been up to, what I've been up to. And separately, he gave me his contact info and told me to contact him. So here, the CEO and one of the highest executives there were both giving me their info and saying to contact them. One of them was someone I knew back in the 2000s and got along with all the time. The other one I just met but was impressed with me. So if there was ever an opportunity to break in to work in the online poker industry, that was it. But I didn't do it. Why didn't I do it? Well, I just decided not to bother with it. I didn't want to lose my neutrality. I didn't want to be seen as a sellout. I didn't want to be afraid to criticize GG Poker if they did anything wrong. It just kind of felt like the wrong thing. I also didn't know if they'd want me to move or something to work wherever they're based or even move to Vegas, which I can't do right now. So maybe logistically it wouldn't have worked. But even if I could have worked from home, I just thought, you know what? Even though I've kind of wanted this for a long time, I also kind of don't. I'm kind of happy just where I am. I can be an observer of the industry. I can be a player. I can be a totally neutral observer and commenter on the industry. And that doesn't make me any money, being an observer and commenter of the industry. But at least I can do it and feel good about it. I'm not sure if I'd feel right. I don't think GG is a bad company. Like, I don't agree with everything they do, but I don't think they're a bad company. But I was like, once I do that, I can't ever say anything bad about them again. And if I criticize the competition, people won't believe me. People will think I'm just doing it as a shill for GG. So it was just something I decided I didn't want. To be clear, I was not offered any position there. I was just kind of getting the vibe that that's where this was going. Or it might have been going. They probably would have wanted to talk to me more. But that's kind of where it seemed to be going. But anyway, that has nothing to do with all this. That's just a little personal story about GG and that party. Do you think if I went to them today that they would hire me? Answer, probably not, because I've been pretty critical of them since then, especially their super user scandal in December 2023, which I felt was mishandled in several ways. I was one of the more aggressive people calling them out and one of the more aggressive people continuing to hassle them about it when they were not giving good answers and it started to die on Twitter and I was kind of keeping it alive. So I'm sure they're not very thrilled with me about that. And not only that, but Steve Priest, Wicked Chops, is no longer with them. He is now with PokerStars, so I wouldn't even have his backing. Anyway, back to the WSOP and their purchase by GG Poker. First of all, it's important to understand that this did not come out of nowhere. WSOP and GG Poker have had a long-time marketing partnership. In fact, if you've looked at the felts at the World Series of Poker, there is a big GG Poker logo right there. GG Poker also has a lot of satellites for non-US players to win their way directly into the WSOP. That is part of the reason that they're getting the fields of more than 10,000 people for the last 2 years. They've also run online WSOP bracelet events in the past. Now, most of those have not been on GG, but there have been some actual online bracelet events run on GG Poker itself for the WSOP. They also run the Canadian WSOP site, which is WSOP.ca. Still, with all that, I never thought Caesars was going to outright sell the World Series of Poker to them. That was a shock to me. That was a shock to pretty much everybody. So I bet you're wondering, what does this mean for the players? What does this mean to you if you're a World Series of Poker player? Well, the first and most important detail is that the WSOP will continue operating at Caesars properties, presumably Paris and Horseshoe like it's been, through at least 2044. They said for 20 years, that's from 25 through 44. So that's a long time. That means it's going to be running there through the time when I'm 72 years old. And honestly, I don't know how much World Series of Poker I'm going to play after I'm 72. I don't know if I'll have the energy to play these long days. I don't know if I'm going to want to risk catching COVID, which I have to assume will still be around in 2044. And at that point, I don't think I want to get it. As you see, I already have a form of long COVID here when I'm 52, which is not dangerous to me, but is a pain in the ass because I keep coughing. But I don't think I'd want to risk my life to play in the worst environment for COVID, which I have to assume will be around then. Now, maybe by then they'll have a cure for it, but I'm not that optimistic. But even if it's not COVID, I'll be 72. I just may not have the energy for it at that point. Anyway, 20 years is a long time, and it's going to remain operating at Caesars Properties. It is not clear if the existing WSOP management, like Jack Effel and Ty Stewart, will remain in place, but I'm guessing they will. It doesn't seem like there's an agreement to keep them in place, but often in these types of purchases, they just leave the existing staff in place because it's easier to transition that way. It's also not clear if GG Poker is going to send their own employees to work at the WSOP, or if all the employees will work for Caesars. My guess is that the staff will be almost all Caesars employees. I'm talking like the dealers, the cashiers, things like that. But possibly some GG Poker managers might get involved. So it's possible like they'll keep Jack Effel around as the tournament director and Ty Stewart as the one over him as the head of the whole World Series. But they may also bring some GG Poker people in to give their feedback on everything and to make sure it runs in a way that GG Poker wants to see it run. So I could picture some GG Poker managers coming in and having say as well, but I don't see GG Poker hiring the dealers and the cashiers and the floor men and stuff like that. So what about the events? What about the rake? What about the structures? Is it going to be decided by Caesars or GG Poker? Well, we don't know yet, but to me it appears that GG Poker bought the intellectual property of the WSOP, and therefore they have the ultimate say in what happens with it. The only thing that they can't do, it appears, is to move the WSOP away from Caesars Properties until after 2044. And apparently they also have to give priority to Caesars Properties to hold circuit events. But beyond that, it seems like GG Poker has the flexibility to basically do what they want with it. But will they change anything? For the moment, I'm guessing probably nothing major. There's the old adage, if it works, don't fix it. And I think we all know the WSOP works. It's very, very successful. It's extremely popular with both pros and recreational players. There's no need to change things, at least not to make major changes. GG Poker might integrate itself more into the marketing and branding, but I think the WSOP itself will be quite similar to what we just saw in 2024. Now, what about the rake? Is it possible that GG might increase the rake? They could. It's not clear how the money will be split between Caesars and GG going forward. Caesars will be getting something out of it because they're going to be operating on other properties for the next 20 years, and they're not going to be doing this for free. But it's not clear if this will just be a rental of their facilities for a flat rate, or if there will be some kind of split of the rake and other forms of profit. But GG Poker might want to increase the rake in order to make back the money they just invested, which is $250 million right on the spot and another $250 in promissory notes to be paid within 5 years. So why would Caesars sell it? I was saying all this time they're never going to sell the WSOP, that it's just too profitable. Well, apparently they need money to pay down their existing debt, which is said to be $12.4 billion. And they also might buy back some stock. So Caesars sees this as a win. They got a cash infusion, and yet they remain the home of the WSOP for the next two decades. So people will still be coming into their properties to play the WSOP, both the regular WSOP and the circuit events. And for two decades, that's going to remain the case. And they're also going to get some share of the profits, I have to assume, or at the very least, they're going to get paid rent by GG Poker to hold it there. Now, what about online? Remember I read you the online part? Well, that's a little bit strange. Caesars is going to retain the right to run WSOP.com in the existing states of New Jersey, Nevada, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. But now they're restricted from operating any online poker sites other than those, quote, for a specified period of time. So that means there won't be any further expansion to WSOP.com to other states unless it's a GG-branded site. So you're not going to see WSOP.com California, WSOP.com Texas, WSOP.com New York. You're not going to see those because the contract says that they can only keep their existing sites in those four states. So it's possible GG Poker could start a site in these other states and then merge their player pool with WSOP. That's not mentioned, but it's possible they could do it. But there definitely will not be WSOP.com run by Caesars in anything but those existing four states. What also isn't clear is if Caesars is allowed to use WSOP branding in future promotional material. So, for example, could they advertise Horseshoe Las Vegas as the home of WSOP? It is, and it's going to be for the next two decades, presumably. But is that a violation of the intellectual property rights agreement? I have to imagine it's spelled out somewhere in the agreement, but that was not in the press release. But it'll be interesting to see if Caesars still promotes their properties as the home of WSOP, or if they can't do that anymore. The association they've had with WSOP has been a selling point for Caesars over the past two decades. Also, I do want to clarify something because I saw a lot of confusion on social media in early August regarding how Caesars acquired the WSOP in the first place. Prior to 2004, WSOP was owned by Binion's Horseshoe, which is not the same as the Horseshoe that's the former Bally's and former MGM Grand and all that. Not the same Horseshoe. The downtown Binion's Horseshoe, which had a different ownership than today. This was owned by the Binion family. So at the time, the owner was Becky Benin, B-E-H-N-E-N. That was Benny Binion's daughter. And she basically ran Binion's into the ground. So it was broke, basically. So they were in big trouble, Binion's. At one point, authorities seized over $1 million from the cashier cage to pay debts to labor unions. So the labor unions were owed money, and Binion's wasn't paying, and they just came. I believe Marshalls came and just shut down the casino for the moment and seized over $1 million out of the cashier cage. Once that happened, the casino was shut down because what little cash they had left could no longer cover the chips that they held, and that's a requirement in Nevada. So they had to shut down, and then Becky Benin was desperate to sell. Harrah's, which was soon going to become Caesars, swooped in and bought it at a bargain. And the reason they did this was not because they wanted the rundown Binion's casino and hotel. It was because they wanted to take the rights to the WSOP and then get rid of it. And that's exactly what they did. So they took the rights to the WSOP. They resold Binion's to a third company. And when it was all said and done, Harrah's and Caesars now had acquired the WSOP brand for essentially free. It was one of their best business decisions of all time. Not only did they make all that money for the past two decades, but now they just sold it for $500 million. Pretty impressive. As players, are we going to notice much of a difference next year when GG Poker owns it? Probably not much. My guess is we're just going to see more GG Poker promotion and branding, but probably pretty similar. I have a feeling that Daniel Negreanu, who already has a lot of influence at the WSOP, will have even more, because he is the main face of GG Poker, as you probably know. So, can you imagine now that GG Poker owns the WSOP, he will probably have tremendous influence at the WSOP. So, that will be interesting to see, too, of what Daniel Negreanu might do regarding the WSOP and changes they might make that he would want. So that will be something to watch as well. He hasn't commented on this. I'm just telling you from everything I'm observing. So that's what we have right now. Not much more to say about that until we figure out more. And we may not figure out more until it comes closer to WSOP time. Had I seen this coming? I don't know. Maybe I should have contacted the CEO back in 2022. Because think, if I were some kind of manager at GG Poker, like some kind of high manager, then I would have a say at the WSOP. Mm-hmm. Now that might be worth it. That might be something that I would like. But I didn't, and that's that. Imagine how all my haters would feel if I were somewhat in control of the WSOP. I bet they wouldn't like that. But I'm not, and I won't be. So they can rest easy. Next, I want to give you an update about the Tropicana. They have selected a date for implosion. The Tropicana, as you know, shut down in April. I happened to be in town when it happened, so I was there on its very last night. I was there about an hour before they closed the casino, played blackjack. Then they shut down, and they've already dismantled a lot of it, but they still have to implode the building, and people have been wondering when that's going to be. They obtained a permit that gave them permission to do an implosion by October 20th. And if they didn't do it by October 20th, 2024, then they would have to apply again. So it wasn't a certainty it would happen before October 20th, but it was somewhat likely. Because why would they even get that permit for it if they weren't planning to do it by then? Anyway, then we heard nothing for a long time. For several months, we heard nothing as far as when they were going to implode it. Finally, on August 26th, it was announced that it is going to be imploded on October 9th at 2:30 a.m. Pacific time. Now, that's a little bit weird. I haven't paid enough attention to the dates of other implosions, but October 9th is a Wednesday. So at 2:30 in the morning, they're going to implode the Tropicana. I have to imagine that's going to make a lot of noise. I have to imagine that's going to be something that wakes people up who live anywhere near there. And there are a lot of people that live somewhat near there. So they're just going to wake up the whole immediate area of town? Like, why can't they do this at 8 p.m.? Why is it at 2:30 a.m.? I don't get it. If it's a matter of not wanting to do it with a lot of people around for whatever reason, they could do it at 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. But why 2:30 a.m. wake up all these people sleeping? Also, people sleeping in nearby hotels. I mean, this is going to be pretty noisy, I have to imagine. For some time, there was discussion that they could not implode it at all because of asbestos in the building, and that it would be unsafe. But then it was determined that there are ways to do it to limit the release of the asbestos. So they were once again given permission to implode. And then, for whatever reason, they took some time to actually settle on a date. But that date is set in stone. It will be 2:30 a.m. on October 9th. Now, what if you want to watch it? What if you want to see the Tropicana Las Vegas be imploded? Well, I hate to tell you, but according to things I am seeing on social media, it is getting pretty expensive to stay in Vegas on October 8th or 9th. So you may be paying a lot of money on what normally would be cheap nights, because the 8th and 9th are weeknights. It's, you know, Tuesday night, Wednesday night. But apparently a lot of people want to come into town and see this because it's a legendary property and people have been kind of fascinated with its closure and now what's going to be its implosion. So this is one of the more legendary properties being imploded in quite some time. And I guess a lot of people want to come and see it. Now, by the time you hear this, it's probably going to be a little bit late for you to get any kind of reasonable deal on a hotel room if you want to see the Tropicana imploded. But I can give you some tips if you want to try to get a room that might still work today. Haven't tried any of these, but just give you some tips which could work for some people. Keep in mind, these are weekdays, and weekdays and weekends in Vegas have a tremendously different price, typically. Tremendously different. For example, did you know, I'm just looking right now here on the Caesars website, did you know that on Tuesday, October 1st and Wednesday, October 2nd, which is a week before, anyone, that means you don't have to have this based on your play, could get a $23 room per night at the Horseshoe. Now, if you're not diamond or above, you'll pay a resort fee of about $50 each. But other than that, it's $23 a night. And again, that's not based upon your play. That's just for any Tom, Dick, and Harry without even a Players Club card could book that rate right now. I'm looking at it right now. Well, a week later, October 8th and 9th, the Horseshoe is $208 on the 8th and $246 on the 9th and even $256 on the 10th. Caesars is $569 on the 8th, $664 on the 9th. The Cromwell, $370 on the 7th, $493 on the 8th, $493 on the 9th. The cheapest you're going to find is the Horseshoe, the $208 and $246. So that's very, very expensive for a weeknight. As I just told you, it was $23 each a week before on Tuesday and Wednesday. So what does this have to do with finding any kind of deal? Well, a lot of people have deals from properties, including Caesars, that are weekday-only deals, where you can stay for free or very cheap on weekdays. And I'm not talking about if you just go to the calendar for how much it's going to cost you. I'm talking if you go to your offers on whatever casino company you're looking at, you know, Caesars, MGM, whatever it might be. And if you see offers for Sunday through Thursday of getting comp rooms, you might still be able to use those offers to get a free room, whereas you'll probably be paying $200 or more for the room if you do it normally through the normal booking process. And that is because some of these casino companies have forgotten to black out the dates of the 8th and the 9th from these offers. So you should check if you have these offers for October and see if you can apply them to the 8th and 9th. So anyway, I won't be there. I am not able to make it, but if you want to go, that's what I would suggest if you can't get a comp room from just looking at the rate calendar when you log in. You may want to see if you have any offers for the weekdays in October, and that may apply. Is it going to be dangerous to watch this, given the asbestos concern? I don't think so. You're not going to be super close by. If you're concerned, you could wear a mask. And you're not going to be exposed for very long. So this is one of those things that it's more likely to harm you for being exposed for a long period of time, or you have a really intense exposure. Being the distance you're going to be for that short a time, I don't see any problem regarding the asbestos. I'm not an expert on that, but that would be my guess. What's going to happen to that property after the Tropicana is imploded? At the moment, nothing. The Oakland A's, who will be leaving Oakland after this baseball season, will not be going to Las Vegas in 2025. They'll be going to Sacramento. And then they'll be in Sacramento for some time and then move elsewhere, which may be Vegas and may not be Vegas. We will see. Could end up in Salt Lake City. Could end up in Portland. Various other places are interested in getting the A's. So we will see. It may or may not happen for Vegas. The property is owned by the Bally Corporation. So presumably, at minimum, there will be a casino built there that's owned by the Bally Corporation. And in fact, they want to do that even if the stadium does go up. Resorts World former CEO Scott Sabella was a shady guy. And I reported that on this show for quite some time, if you remember, way before the media was covering it. And Nevada gaming seemed to look the other way at the time. But now things are starting to happen. So Nevada gaming has filed a complaint against Resorts World for allowing illegal bookies to gamble there and launder money. The Nevada Gaming Control Board tweeted on August 15th, Nevada Gaming Control Board filed a complaint against Resorts World Las Vegas and its affiliate companies for alleged violations of Nevada gaming laws. NGCB alleges that Resort World's compliance issues damaged Nevada and its gaming industry. And then they put a link to the full complaint. The link they have actually has several documents you can read, and it mentions a number of different individuals. Basically, the main person who is alleged to have used Resorts World to both launder money and possibly lay off action that they didn't want to just cover themselves was Matthew Bowyer, who was in the mainstream news earlier this year as the illegal bookmaker who took bets from Shohei Ohtani's assistant, Ippe Mizuhara. And it turned out that Mizuhara stole Ohtani's money to cover his major gambling habit. Now, as we talked about on the show, it is possible that Mizuhara was also placing some of these bets on behalf of Ohtani, but he did plead guilty in federal court to having stolen Ohtani's money for purposes of continuing to gamble at high stakes. At minimum, he did steal at least some of that money and gambled with Bowyer. So this entire thing came out in March due to the arrest and investigation of Bowyer. I'm talking about the Ohtani stuff, which is a big story that people heard about all over the country, even if they were not fans of baseball or following gambling news. So Matthew Bowyer is the main bookie accused of being allowed to gamble at Resorts World. And it's alleged that executives there, including CEO Scott Sabella, knew about it and looked the other way, even though that they knew what Bowyer was and where he got his money. Interestingly, a newly revealed angle involves Bowyer's wife, Nicole, who is an independent host associated with Resorts World. So she was apparently earning a commission on the losses incurred by her husband, Matt Bowyer, and his associates. That's kind of an interesting piece there. Matt Bowyer was trying to launder money at Resorts World that he had made through his illegal gambling operation, his bookmaking operation. So then he would go to Resorts World and gamble it to clean up the money and then cash it out as supposed gambling winnings. And in addition, his wife was getting a commission on those losses that her husband was incurring, because it was losses because he's just playing negative EV games. But of course, this is with illegally obtained money, and then it cleans up the money. So then even though he's taking losses, then at least he's getting some of it back through his wife that's earning a commission on his losses, which is interesting. So she is a piece of this as well. Resorts World was said to have looked the other way as Bowyer and his associates were gambling at Resorts World, and that they did not inquire about the source of funds. And in fact, it's alleged that they knew the source of funds and didn't care. Matt Bowyer pled guilty in early to mid-August in federal court to illegal bookmaking and money laundering. So it's not a question as to whether Bowyer was doing this. He's already pled guilty to it. He has not been sentenced yet. The most harsh penalty that could come down here would be a complete loss of license for Resorts World. Now, CEO Sabella is gone. He's been fired since the federal charges were filed against him a little while back. And that doesn't just have to do with Resorts World, it also has to do with MGM and some other matters that have nothing to do with Matt Bowyer. So he's not there anymore. But Resorts World could lose their license over this. I don't think they will. It is possible that they could be told they have to sell, and that's the only way the license can come back if it has a new owner. But I don't think it's going to happen. The owner of Resorts World is Genting, which is a huge company out of Malaysia. And currently their lawyers are dealing with the Nevada Gaming Commission, and they're trying to smooth things out. I have to imagine there's going to be some very, very large fine, but I don't think they're going to actually take away their license. Resorts World is not doing well. They're struggling, and Fountain Blue is struggling even more. So these new North Strip casinos are just not getting it done. People just don't want to go over there. People just aren't used to high-end casinos being there. And that area of town is not great. And people know it's not great. And it's kind of hard to walk to from the casinos people normally go to. So that's really killing these two places. There is some belief that with Resorts World struggling as it is, that could also possibly impact what fine that they're going to pay. But of course, Genting is very large, and they have pretty deep pockets, so that may not affect it that much. There will be something here. Nevada Gaming looked the other way on this matter for a long time. I was shocked at everything Sabella was alleged to have done. And it just seemed like gaming wasn't interested, and it seemed like local Las Vegas media was not interested. I think the Nevada Current and Nevada Independent were reporting on it some, but these are the small publications. But the main publications in Vegas were not covering it at all until Sabella got in trouble. But prior to that, they were just ignoring everything that was getting pretty egregious. That guy, Robinhood702, has been calling this out for a while. But people don't take him completely seriously because he's not the greatest person himself. He's got a lot of history of his own, including being a snitch. So Robinhood702 is someone you have to take with a grain of salt. He's also very conspiratorial. But he was right on about Scott Sabella. And he was trying to warn people for a long time about him. But once Sabella got charged by the feds and was fired, then the media had no choice but to cover it. And then once the whole Boyer thing happened with Ohtani, which became a huge story, then gaming had to do something. Gaming had to show that they were taking the matter seriously. They have to basically show the public and show the feds that they're not letting Resorts World get away with this, for looking the other way while major, major bookies were using their property to launder money. And their CEO knew about it. A related piece to this whole thing, a poker player who has been seen on two different poker streams is also apparently a part of this. Damien LeForbes, LeForbes, also known as DJ, appeared sometimes on Hustler Casino Live and Poker Go. He has pled guilty to money laundering and illegal bookmaking in relation to the Matt Boyer case. He calls himself a professional poker player, but that's not really true. He was actually a professional bookmaker, and he has admitted this in federal court. As I said, he pled guilty. He's alleged to have been one of the co-conspirators in the Matt Boyer ring. According to Action Network, over an 11-month period through December 15, 2023, LeForbes wagered more than $148 million at Resorts World. LeForbes also used various cryptocurrency wallets to receive proceeds from his business and pay bettors that he owed money. And then He would transfer this crypto, but never used public exchanges, so it wouldn't be reported to the feds. He also racked up $12 million in gambling losses at Resorts World, and apparently he passed a $2.5 million bad check to Resorts World at one point. It is alleged that LeForbes was one of the people who was laundering money at Resorts World on behalf of Matt Boyer. Someone on Twitter told me that this is incorrect, and I don't really know this guy. but someone on Twitter was very insistent today, in fact, that Bowyer was a separate bookie from LaForbes, that these were just two bookies who knew each other, and that they were just both using Resorts World to gamble, but for different purposes. So this guy was saying that Bowyer was using Resorts World to launder money, and LaForbes was just a degenerate. That could be partially believable because, as I said, he passed a bad check. Also, LaForbes owes $1 million to the Venetian, and that has been sent to the Clark County District Attorney. At the moment, Clark County's DA is not attempting to charge LaForbes for the bad check to Resorts World either. It's not clear why. It's possible that the word just got around that Resorts World is a place that's not going to ask you about your source of funds, whether you're trying to launder money or just you like gambling. So yeah, it is possible that LaForbes was just a degenerate who blew the money that he was making through his bookmaking operation in various Las Vegas casinos. So I don't know if he has a direct connection to Bowyer or not. It's kind of unclear. Or if he was a completely separate bookie. But he definitely was a bookie and has pled guilty to that and pled guilty to money laundering. So he was doing some kind of money laundering. Anyway, we'll see what happens with Resorts World. I'll definitely update that story when some kind of penalty comes down. There will be some kind of penalty because they made a pretty serious series of violations here. They got to do something. It would not look good at all for Nevada Gaming if they just let Resorts World off the hook on this one. I guess I'll do one more topic. The Rio, the new Rio, that is not doing particularly well. In fact, they are struggling, just as I predicted they would, and now people are getting fired, and others are quitting. So the new Rio was bought by a company called Dreamscape for $516 million. They bought that from Caesars. For whatever reason, they did zero market research, or if they did, it was done poorly, and it was not discovered that the Rio brand now has a negative connotation due to the decades of Caesars neglect. Most tourists don't closely follow Vegas news, and they hear Rio, and they assume it's still the same shithole under Caesars ownership. They really do. Like, most people don't even know it's a new property at this point. Well, it's not a new property, but a newly renovated property with new owners that's not known to the general public very well. But it didn't just stop at $516 million. They also put a lot of money into renovating both the interior and exterior of the Rio, and I admit that from the outside it looks much nicer. They installed some pretty cool lights on the outside. It just looks like a sleeker property. It looks kind of cool now from the outside. But there's still no real theme. There's no party atmosphere, which people liked so much in the 1990s. And there's still an air of incompetence and confusion which hangs in the place, which doesn't make it too different from the Caesars days. In fact, it's worse. I actually stayed there in early July, and I had a pretty bad interaction with the front desk employee who checked me in. It seemed like the woman at the front desk had already mentally signed out from the night, even though she was still at work, meaning she just was kind of done, I think. She was going to go home pretty soon, and I think she was just annoyed with my entire check-in, even though I wasn't doing anything wrong. So you may not realize this, but after 3 a.m. can be a tough time to check in Las Vegas properties, because most casino hotels will auto-cancel your reservation at 3 in the morning. So if you're going to get there after 3, you need to call in and tell them this so they can make sure not to cancel you. Now, if you don't call in, your room isn't gone. You can come in there and get the room back, provided there's still room for you. But it's not a good idea because you'll get one of the worst rooms in the house. You just want to let them know if you're going to be there after 3 a.m. on the first night that you're coming in after 3. So knowing this, I called them up and I let them know on this particular night in July that I was going to be there at about 4:30 a.m. And they said, okay, thank you. And they even blocked a room for me and everything seemed good. So I got to the Rio and I get to the front desk and I say, I'm here to check in. And the front desk woman says, okay, that'll be a $50 early check-in fee. Are you aware of that? And I said, oh, no. I'm not checking in early. I'm actually checking in late. This is for last night's reservation and I'm just coming in now. And I already called and told them I'd be here at this time. Well, at this point, she looked really annoyed, like I was pulling a fast one or something. So she actually scoffed. She's like, okay, I hear this like visible frustration. Like, what did I do? I'm coming in at 4:30 a.m. to check in my room. That's not my fault that I'm not checking in early. I'm checking in late. It's like she was so wanting to just charge that $50 early check-in fee and be done. When I said it's last night, I think it's because it was more work. She had to go pull up the previous night's reservation. There was more to do, I think. I think that was the problem. She was already frustrated. So then I frustrated her further. I said, can you please put me facing the quiet side and away from the elevator? And she said, we don't have anything like that. You're already assigned to a room. So I said, okay, well, can you tell me, you know, where am I? Well, yeah, you're not facing the quiet side, and yeah, you're kind of by the elevator. I go, okay, well, can you see what's available? So another scoff. And she hammers away at the computer and finds a room which she thinks meets my description. So I said, okay, is it away from the elevator? Because the room she gave me ended in 00. So I said, that sounds like it might be right by the elevator. So she said, it is right by the elevator. I'm like, what? I just told you I didn't want by the elevator. Why are you giving me 00 right by the elevator? So I was still polite. I said, oh, well, I'm going to be sleeping late. If you don't mind, I'd like to be away from the elevator. Another scoff. Very unhappy with me. So she's tapping away at the computer. Says she found another room, but then she said it may not be on the quiet side. She thinks it is, but she's not sure. I'm like, okay, fine. I was tired. I just want to get it. Well, yeah, fine. I'll take that one. So she reprogrammed the keys. And then about 30 seconds later, I decided I don't want to gamble with this. I decided I'd just rather be by the elevator and at least face the quiet side. So I said, you know what? I'm sorry about this, but I do want to take that room he gave me ending in 00 because at least I know it's facing the right way. So she seemed really annoyed, even more than before. So then she tapped just a few keys on the keyboard and said, okay, I've moved you back. Is there anything else I can help you with? And I said, well, yeah, you reprogrammed my keys to this other room. And then I took this one ending in 00 back. So don't you have to reprogram the keys again? And she said, no, I don't. That'll work. I said, I've never seen that before. Whenever you program keys to another room, it doesn't just follow the person if you change the room. You have to reprogram the keys. In fact, you even have to reprogram the keys if they're going to last a little bit longer. Like if I asked for a late checkout, you need to reprogram them. So how could you not have to reprogram here? She says, oh, it'll work, I assure you. I don't have to reprogram them. They're good. I said, I've never seen this before where there's a room change and the keys still work. And she said, I changed it back. It'll work, I promise you. So I dragged my stuff all the way to the Masquerade Tower, which was pretty far away from the front desk. Get up to my room, which turned out to be at the end of the hallway, not by the elevator. She was wrong about that one, too. Get all the way there. And my keys don't work. Are you surprised? I bet you're not surprised. This was intentional. This is on purpose. She got tired of me. She hated me from the moment that I wasn't paying the $50 early check-in fee, which wasn't me getting out of a fee. It was a fee that wasn't supposed to be charged because I was checking in late, not early. She just thought I was coming in early for the next day. That was the beginning of her annoyance with me, and then I'm asking for these room locations, and she just wants to, you know, drop me in a room and get me out of there. So everything I asked for, she's getting angrier and angrier, and she decided she's going to fuck with me and leave me with bad keys. So I knew it was on purpose. I was very annoyed with this. I had to call security. Security came and checked my ID and let me in, and I was not happy about that. I did put in a complaint about it the next day. And I gave them the keys, and I said, go ahead and check these keys. You'll see that they were programmed to the other room, and it was probably intentional. Surprisingly, her manager said, yes, I agree with you. I think it probably was intentional. She wasn't even defending her. She said, yeah, you know, it does sound like that. And in fact, we're not even going to check the keys. I believe you completely. I think this was intentional, and we're going to have a word with her about this. She sounded pretty sincere, too. So the only thing I was paying for that room, fortunately, was the resort fee. the room was comp, so that's all I was paying. So she took off the resort fee to make it completely comp. So at least that was nice. It was only a one-night stay, so wasn't much further to do. Anyway, hopefully that manager I dealt with still has a job, and the reason I think she might not is that Rio just fired 30 managers in what could only be described as a downsizing. Also, many executives have flown the coop. This, according to Vital Vegas, who wrote, Rio recently lost its president, Trevor Shearer, who stepped down due to a medical issue. Rio also lost its CFO, Janice Fitzpatrick. She left in February 2024. Also no longer at the Rio is VP of Finance, Jason Ansuni. He left Rio in May 2024 and now is VP of Analytics at Resorts World. Patrick Hoefler stepped down from the position of Rio's VP of Food and Beverage in June of 2024. Rio's vice president of sales position has been vacant for several months following a departure. We've heard several other high-ranking executives have moved on as well since Dreamscape took over operations from Caesars, but our LinkedIn search hand is cramping up, frankly. You get the picture. From what we can tell, these executive departures were related to other opportunities. They weren't pushed out or part of any cost-cutting initiative. So that's being a little bit too generous by Vital Vegas, saying that they left for other opportunities. Usually, people leaving a new Vegas casino for, quote, other opportunities, new or newly taken over. So if their executives are leaving for, quote, other opportunities, usually means that the executives see a sinking ship and want to jump the fuck off. That's usually what that means. So I think Rio was just drawing dead. They had no shot at success as a medium high-end resort, especially not with the existing Rio name. So Dreamscape wasted their money. Not only does the Rio have a bad reputation already, and people don't even realize that as new owners, but the location's terrible. The location is on the other side of the 15 freeway. It's not on the strip. It's not easy to walk to the strip from there. People just don't want to be over there anymore. People never really wanted to be there, but at least the Rio had its own appeal back then with that show in the sky and the whole party theme, so people went out there. But now, there's no reason to go. I don't care if it looks nicer, it's been renovated. It doesn't matter. People don't want to be over there. Now, if it's really cheap, sure, but this is never going to work as a medium high-end hotel. This would only work as a cheap hotel over there, a place where people will go because they can't afford the strip. But if you can afford the strip, you're not going to want to stay at the Rio. I don't know how Dreamscape didn't realize that. It's crazy. It's not like they brought back the stuff that people liked in the 90s there. They didn't. So basically, Rio is putting out the message that, hey, we've gotten a better idea of staffing requirements. So that's why these layoffs have happened. It's just we overestimated staffing, and now we're more in tune of what we really need, which is a nice way of saying we can't have all these managers because nobody's coming here. We can't afford that. So we got to cut costs. Does not surprise me one bit. Not one bit. I knew that was not going to work out. It's just going to get worse there. I'll say something else, and this is the reason I told you the little check-in story where I was purposely given a bad key, which, by the way, I think is the first time in my life I was purposely given a bad key. I've had bad keys before, but all those other times, it was just due to some kind of mistake. This is the first time I was purposely given a bad key, and in fact, I suspected it before I even verified it was bad. But the reason I told that story is that absolutely should not have happened. Not just the purposely giving me a bad key part. The whole interaction sucked. And when you're struggling, when you're a hotel, a casino that's struggling, you've got to kiss the customer's ass. You've got to make the customer happy to be there. You've got to give the customer a good experience. And this should be hammered into the heads of all employees, that you be friendly at all times. You never give an attitude. You never act frustrated. This woman was frustrated from the very moment that I said, I'm checking in late, not early. And I said it very politely. When she said it's a $50 check-in fee, I didn't go, no, no, you're wrong. No, no. Like, I wasn't like that. It was just, oh, no, no, no. I'm checking in late, actually, not early. And that just got her mad. Like, I said it just like that. And she got mad. Now, I know they can't control every single employee. I know that you'll have bad employees in a big place, and there's no way to avoid that. I understand that, but it just kind of seems like, from what I can tell by the way she was behaving, it just hadn't been hammered into her head that you've got to treat everyone real well. And if you're struggling, you got to do that, because the last thing the Rio needs is people who are not going to come back because they're treated shitty by the front desk or other employees there. Now, losing me isn't the worst thing for them, because all I did is just stay there and leave. I didn't even play. So I'm not the worst one for them to lose. I might come back and play at some point. I just didn't have time that day. But I'm not really talking about myself here. I'm talking about the typical tourist that's coming in that they're trying to bring over to the property and get to like the property and keep staying there and playing there. You got to give them a good experience. You have to try harder than the strip properties, because at least the strip properties have their location to offer. You guys don't. So you got to go above and beyond. And if you have front desk employees with an attitude, as this one definitely did, then that's a problem. I will say the manager the next day was nice, but that initial check-in was really shitty. Maybe I just happened to get the worst employee there. I don't know. Maybe it was bad luck, but wasn't a good sign, and definitely the place is a ghost town, and they need a lot more people going through, staying there and playing there, and they're just not getting it. I think they're only getting it in very crowded times where all the hotels are full. Okay, well, that's all I'm going to do. At least we did multiple topics here. At least we did five topics. Not bad, right? Kind of powered through them, too. Didn't even ramble. The new efficient Poker Fraud Alert Radio. We get five topics done in less than 2 hours. And no long intro. What do you think of that? COVID just like knocked out my desire to do long intros. So the haters of the long intro, you can be happy. What about this? This isn't quite the way we usually close. Same song, but being played in a different way. This was a live performance on a solo piano by Roger Kellaway, who wrote this song, the end song of All in the Family. This was from a concert in 1987 where he performed it. Doesn't quite sound exactly the same as what I usually play, which is more produced. And I don't believe it's only on one piano. I don't know, I just found this on YouTube and decided I'd close this way instead. As far as I know, Roger Kellaway is still alive, which is pretty amazing, because he wrote this song in 1969 for the end of All in the Family. So you'd have to think that somebody who wrote the end song of a TV show in 1969, which is now 55 years ago, would be dead. Like, for example, if he were 40 when he did that, he'd be 95 now. But Roger Kellaway was actually young at the time he did this. He was a good deal younger than 40. He was only 30. He was born in fact, probably 29. He was born in late 1939. So he is 84 years old right now. Still alive. I don't know if he's still performing. Definitely the biggest thing he ever did was write the end song to All in the Family. He did get his song kind of appropriated by Carol O'Connor. I think I've mentioned this before. Carol O'Connor asked him if he could write lyrics to the end song of All in the Family, and Kellaway's like, oh, sure, I'm flattered that you want to do that, because, of course, Carol O'Connor's a much bigger star than he is. So Carol O'Connor wrote lyrics and performed them on some TV special while Kellaway played in the background. So, okay, fine. But O'Connor demanded that it says in the credits at the end of All in the Family, you can see this if you watch the end credits, that this song called Remembering You at the end of the show was written by Carol O'Connor and Roger Kellaway. It wasn't. It was written by Roger Kellaway. And then Carol O'Connor asked if he could just add lyrics, which were not used at the end of All in the Family. So the lyrics that Carol O'Connor wrote himself were not used anywhere except by him. So why should he get credit for this at the end of All in the Family when he wrote lyrics after the fact? If I go find some instrumental song and write lyrics to it, do I get to demand that the original author gives me credit for writing the song if it's not used anywhere in my lyrics? But I have to assume Kellaway didn't object to this because Carol O'Connor was a big star and you don't want to make an enemy of him. He should clear it up now, though. Carol O'Connor's been dead for 20 years. So that's trivia that very few people know. Few people know about the lyrics being written, but not the whole thing about Kellaway being screwed there. Anyway, thank you for listening to Poker Fraud Alert Radio. I'll try to do another episode not too long to get to the other topics we haven't talked about yet. Good night and shalom. Thank you. I appreciate it.